As I said before, Esther is a unique book in the Bible. In fact, it is so unique that there were many theologians in time past who thought that it should not even be included in the canon of Scripture. And the reason for that is that Esther is a heavily history book. It's a book of history. It tells us the story of a woman by the name of Esther and how she was used to rescue all of the Jews that were in captivity at that time. But the thing is that God is not mentioned. The name of the Lord isn't mentioned. God isn't alluded to in any way, shape, or form. There's no prayer in this book. There's no seeking God in this book. There's no one who brings up lessons of what it's like to serve or follow God. And so many have looked at it and said, it just seems to be a secular history of an event that took place in the lives of the Jews. But I do believe it is supposed to be in the canon of Scripture. Because you see, when the Jews were taken into captivity, God had said it was because they had become rebellious and they had turned their back upon them. And remember that the term Jews is actually a derivative from Judah. And you remember that Israel was divided into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And that Assyria took Israel into captivity and Babylon took Judah into captivity. Those that went into captivity in Babylon were known as Jews. And there are several references here in Esther calling them Jews as a form of Judah, that they were taken into captivity and they were from that area of Judah. A little different connotation than what you might think of today when someone uses that word. But the Bible uses it here in this book. It also uses it in Ezra in that way. Again, as kind of a break off from Judah. But in doing that, when it's interesting in the book of Psalms, the children of captivity wrote a psalm and they said, we don't want to call out to God if we're not in Jerusalem. They really felt like they were here and they were in captivity and that their relationship with God was stifled. But we know from the history of Ezra, from Nehemiah, from 1st and 2nd Kings, from 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that they had turned their back upon God and God had brought them into captivity. And that when they were in captivity, they weren't seeking God, at least not to a large degree. They had become highly secularized, if you understand that term. It means that even though they were Jewish, they had become secular in their belief. And even though they might have believed in God and believed that a God existed, they were no longer serving or trying to follow the areas and the things of God. So it might be easy for us to say, if that's the case, then God certainly would take his hand off of them. That God would say, we're just going to take our hand off of you in whichever direction you go. He certainly didn't have to remain working with those who were in captivity, because by the time the book of Esther starts, Nehemiah had already built the walls. Ezra had already restored the temple. Somewhere around 50,000 of those in captivity in Babylon had already gone back to the land. And several thousand more had come out of Assyria from the nation of Israel back into the land. And so the nation of Israel was already repopulated and they didn't have God didn't have to remain faithful to them in order to fulfill his promises to Israel, because there were those that had come back in and were worshiping and serving. But see, the Bible says even when we are faithless, God is faithful. And even though they weren't seeking God, even though in the midst of a tragedy like we're going to be reading about here, they didn't call out to God in the midst of that, God in his faithfulness still used providence to guide them. And that's the word that's going to come up again and again in our study of the book of Esther. See, there is predestination and there is providence. And they're kind of the same thing, but they're a little bit different. Predestination is the term by which God gets done in our lives what he wants to do. The idea of destiny, predestination. I have a destiny that God's given me. Now, I also have a free will. And I can make a decision to go my own way, and I can make a decision to do my own things in my free will. But I also believe that there are certain destinies that I can't do anything about. I believe being a part of Calvary Chapel of Tucson was a destiny that God had for me. Providence is the means by which God puts the pieces together in order to get you where he has planned for you. And I can look back in my life and I can see God's providence at work. I can see certain decisions that were made that I thought I'm just making these decisions, or certain events that took place in my life to help direct me in the way that I would go, that I look back and think that's the hand of God. That's providence in my life. It's interesting to me that I believe God's providence was working even while I was backslidden. You remember that I shared with you that at 18 years old, I'd served God since I was 14 to 18. And at 18 years old, I backslid. I went out into the world. I began to live for myself. And had a motorcycle. I'm coming down from, I was going to say Mount Lemmon, but that would be here. I'm coming down from the Crest, which are in the Sandias in Albuquerque, where I grew up. And I'm coming down the Crest, and it's the same kind of a road. It's a curvy, windy road. And I'm on this motorcycle, and I'm going faster than I ought to be going. And I decide to pass a car that's in front of me. And as I go around the car, they had just repaved the road, and they paved it up to a cattle guard. And at the cattle guard, they left a lip, and they put two big signs up that said, slow. And so I come around this car, and I just enough time to straighten up and see slow going by me. My front tire comes up like I'm doing a wheelie, and that felt natural. That felt okay, you know, like, yeah, that's... And then my back tire hit the curb that was there and completely flipped the bike over. And I slid. Later on, we measured it. I slid for 115 feet. The car that I had passed, which was directly behind me, when they came up, and I got up, by the way, and I got up, and I got, I have leather gloves on, I have a full face helmet on, there's a tire mark across my the face where my full face helmet was, my knees, in the last, I don't know what it was, 20 feet, 25 feet, I kind of lost presence of mind, which I think that you do in something like that, and I got up on my knees, and now I'm sliding on my knees, and I have jeans on, but it completely goes through the jeans and just peels off my skin. I still have scars. My legs are pretty white, and I won't show you, but I still have scars that are even whiter where the, you know, my knees rubbed up against that asphalt then. And I stood up, and the people behind me came up there. Are you okay? And my bike is laying on the ground going, blink, the turn signal's on, blink, 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 blink. And they said later on, you look like Evel Knievel at Caesar's Palace. You just were like, pyong, pyong. And even when I wrecked, I remember hitting the ground, because I'm probably going in excess of 60 miles an hour at this point. And when I hit the ground, I had these leather gloves on, and I stuck my hands out to stop myself. Which, if you ever get in a wreck, by the way, you don't do that. And my hands just were like, you know, spaghetti. They just moved right under me. That's the way people break their arms or their legs when they try to stop themselves by doing that. And I just rolled down 115 feet, and I got up, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. How easy would it have been for me to break my neck there? How easy would it have been for me? The bike landed on top of me, landed on my head, which I had the helmet on. My dad used to say, as long as it hits your head, Robert, you're safe. And I guess, you know, he was right. But how easy would it have been for that bike to have landed on me and for me to have died in that accident? And I look back, and I have always seen God's hand in that wreck. I look back, and I think God could have very easily have said to me, what are you doing? You're away from me. You no longer want to serve me and follow me, and I'm going to take you. And God could have taken me in that moment in a heartbeat. But God's providence was there. And even though I was rebellious, God said, I love you. And I have this plan for you, and I'm not going to let you die because of a stupid decision. First one, which was to get the motorcycle. From there were several other stupid decisions that went along those lines. Not that it's stupid to have a motorcycle, but in my frame of mind, maybe even my personality, which is to kind of like the thrill ride stuff, you know, it was stupid for me to have one because I didn't control the way that I rode it. There are other times that I could share with you. As I saw God's hand of providence, God had predestined something for me. This is what he had determined beforehand. It is my destiny to be here with you tonight. Is my destiny. I believe that with all my heart. But God's providence brought me there. Maybe you've got the same kind of things. And see, you can't see providence from this end of it. Looking into your future, or even while the events are taking place, you really can't tell that it's providence. Until years down the road, and you look back, and you go, that was the providence of God. And even though you might not be serving him, even though you might have turned your back upon him, his providence is still at work for God to bring the things that he has determined for you. Now, by the way, when we talk about predestination, it doesn't mean that God predestines every aspect of your life. Doesn't mean that if you get a drink of water, that God predestined for you to get that drink of water at that moment in time. The Bible says, whom he foreknew. In other words, he knew that you would make a decision to follow him. He knew that you would invite him into your life. Whom he foreknew, he also predestined that you would be conformed into the image of his son. What's his destiny for you? That you would be conformed into the image of Jesus Christ. He wants you to be like Jesus. That is the destiny that God has for you. And the providence in our lives brings us there. But I also believe that each of us have certain things that God's called us to. Certain things that God knows, decisions that we're going to make, and He has predestined us according to those decisions that we make. And providence is at work in our lives, even at times when we might not deserve God's providence at all. That's what we find in the book of Esther. We find a people who face a crisis, and in the midst of the crisis, don't even call out upon God, and yet God puts things into place. It just so happens. It just so happens. It just so happens all the way through. Now, first of all, let's pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 1. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus." And by the way, these names are going to kill me as I'm making my way through these chapters tonight. The king Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus is not the name of a man. Ahasuerus is the title. It's like the Pharaoh of Egypt. There was the Ahasuerus of the Persians. So we're going to be talking about those who were ruling Persia. Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar was it dominated the world. He brought, captured all of the known world to them. He wasn't over in the area of Europe, but he was in their area, further east than that he did. And then the kings of Persia took over. Then Persia defeated Babylon and had taken over. That's where we are now. Persia is the headquarters, by the way. Anybody got an idea what nation today is Persia? Iran. That's exactly right. So Babylon is Iraq. And so when Daniel is taken into Babylon, he's taken to the area of Iraq. And Persia is Iran. It's just right across the Euphrates from them. Persia is Iran. And so you have now, we're reading about a king who is a king in Iran. And at that particular point in time, they were the ones that controlled the world. They were the superpower for the world. This guy, probably King Xerxes, by the way, who was a man who tried to actually go over and enter into Europe and defeat Europe and was defeated in trying to do that. It's probably who this king was. It says this was Ahasuerus. It would be like them saying this is the Pharaoh. This is Ahasuerus who reigned over the 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. So you get the wide span of the area that he controlled. It says, "In those days, King Ahasuerus sat on the throne in his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel." You remember that that's where Nehemiah was when the word of the Lord came to him. He said, "I was in Shushan, in citadel." And as I did when I went over Nehemiah, always makes me think of Sean Connery saying that. "I was in Shushan, the citadel." Fits perfect. Then in verse 3, "That the third year of his reign had made a feast for all the officials and servants and powers of Persia, Media, the nobles, the princes, and the provinces being before him." About 181 provinces plus all of their entourage that they would bring with them. We're going to read in a minute that this feast that he puts together, which is basically a party, lasts for 180 days. It says, "When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom in its splendor and excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all." Now, what he's wanting to do is this. He wants to show off. He's taken over this nation that's a huge nation, and he has all of the vast wealth that Babylon had before, and now it belongs to him. And so he wants to show off. So he gathers all of these different men together from all of these different nations. And people have tried to calculate how much it would have cost him to have a feast for this many people for that many days. And it would be tens of millions of dollars in our day, if not into the billions in our day, in order to do this, to bring people in, to put them up for that long. It goes on to say in verse 5, "And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days. So they kind of opened it up to everybody in the end of those 180 days. For the last 7 days, not only were the people from all around the world that had come just to look at the splendor of Persia and his empire, now he brings in all these other people, and they're all feasting there with them. And it says, "For all of the people were present in Shushan the citadel, both great and small, in the court, in the garden of the king's palace." So he opened it up to everybody. They've been feasting all of these different provinces for 180 days. The last 7 days, it's opened up for everybody. And the food is flowing. And as we're going to see, the wine is flowing as well. It goes on to give some descriptions. It says, "There was a white and blue linen, curtains fastened with cords and fine linen and purple and silver robes and marble pillars and couches were of gold and silver." And it goes on to say in verse 7, "And they served drinks in golden vessel, each vessel being different from the other, meaning they didn't kind of do it in a, that when they created them, they're created individually, and each created on their own, which would have taken a lot longer to make than if somebody tried to create, you know, 20 gold, you know, glasses, golden glasses by themselves. It says, with royal wine in abundance. So there's a lot of wine there, and it says, according to the generosity of the king. The king was just showing off. That's all he's doing. He's got everything open. He's got all these marble pillars. He's got these curtains with this exotic fabric that's from around the world. He's got everybody in there. He's got all kinds of wine that is there. It says, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsion or a compulsory, which means that they didn't make anybody drink. He didn't have to do it. For so the king had ordered the officers of the household that they should do according to a man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women. Now, they divided the partying. They had the men partying and feasting in one place, and Queen Vashti, who was Ahasuerus' wife, or Xerxes' wife, was over a feast over the women, and they kept them separate. And so she makes a feast for them, so not only do they have the cost of the feast for the men, but now they got the cost of the feast for the women. It goes on to say then, in the palace belonging to King Ahasuerus, and then verse 10, and on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. In other words, he began to drink. Now his heart is merry with wine. He's a little bit drunk. It says, he commanded Mehumim, Bezebeth, and these other guys that are here, I'm not going to try to pronounce. Verse 11, to bring Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty. Now, not only does he want to show off his kingdom and all the exotic things that are there and the marble pillars and all the gold and the wine and the food and that he can afford to do all of these things. By the way, he's just about ready to go to war with Europe, but he's going to attack Greece. And he's initially going to be successful with an army of 2 million men, by the way. He's initially going to be successful, and then he will be defeated because it takes so much to take Greece initially. He loses almost all of his navy in doing so, and he is driven back, and he comes back like 3 years later, defeated, not able to take Europe as he thought he was. And it's thought that he threw this feast, not only the account of Scripture, but also secular accounts. It's thought that he threw this feast in order to show all of his provinces that they need to join him in this battle because of how influential and powerful he is. Now he wants to show off his wife. She's very beautiful. Her name means beautiful. And he wants to bring her in. It says, and she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command and brought him his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious and his anger burned within him. So she just says, no, she knows what it's all about. These guys are drunk. These guys have been drinking. And it was an unreasonable request for a man to bring in his wife and to show her off that way, being the king or not. And Queen Vashti said, I will not go, and I will not put myself in that place. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for there was the king's manner towards all who knew the law of justice, those closest to him being this guy and that guy and the other guy and that guy, and Mimikan, we'll pronounce him because we'll see him again in a moment, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do with Queen Vashti according to the law? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus and brought to her by the eunuchs. And Mimikin answered before the king and the princes, saying, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also the princes and the people who are in all of the provinces of Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women. They're afraid of a woman's movement is what they're afraid of. It'll become known to all women. All these women are going to be at home, you know, with their rolling pins. All right, now you're going to do what I say. No longer going to obey you at all. So that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. And you got to think, Mimikin, what was his wife like that he's scared about this, you know? Maybe she was Helga, you know, and he's like, don't give, you know, her any ideas. It says, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him. And she did not, that she was called man to become a form, and she didn't come. It says, verse 19, This very day, the nobles and the leaders of Persia and Medes will say to all of the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen, and they will be there will be excessive contempt and wrath. And of course, all of this is just paranoia on their part. It says, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, which we know from the book of Daniel that the laws of the Persians and the Medes could not be reversed. Once they were given by a king, not even the king himself could reverse them. It says, and shall come no more, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus. So their suggestion is that they remove her as being queen. She can no longer come before him. And it said, and let the king give his royal position to another who is better than she, who eventually will be Esther. So then verse 20, when the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all of the empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So again, it just cracks me up that they're so scared of their women. It says, and the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to all the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all of the king's province, and each province in its own script, and every people in their own language, and each man should master his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided. He remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what he had decreed against her. Now, if this is Xerxes, which it probably is, he goes to war, he comes back 3 years later, now he begins to think about his wife and the decree that he made. And now he's sad. Some could say he's lovesick. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Go out through all of the kingdom and seek the most beautiful of all of the virgins. And let the king appoint officers in every province and kingdom that they might gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, or Shushan the citadel, into the woman's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch. So this one guy would have the job of bringing in all of these beautiful young men, women, and watching over them. And some might say, yeah, it's a job I would want, except that he was a eunuch. You know what eunuch means? It means, well, you would never desire a woman. It says, custodian of the woman, and let beauty preparations be given to them. So they would bring in these women, they would give them these beauty preparations, then they're going to bring them before the king. Then it says, then let the young women who please the king and the queen instead of Vashti, or let this young woman please the king, be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So now they're going to have a beauty contest going out into all the world, and they're going to bring them in. I wonder if there was a miscongeniality aspect to it. I wonder, you know, you get my point. It says, in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, and Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured by king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Mordecai had brought up Hadassiah, that is Esther, we'll call her that from now on, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now we think about Esther. We know that we're introduced to her here. We know that she is blessed with an incredible beauty. And she wins the beauty contest out of all of the people who are chosen from all over the provinces of all over the world that he controls. And Esther is eventually chosen. So we know that she is very beautiful. But we also know that she's had some hardships in her life. Her father, mother have been killed. She lives with Mordecai, she loves her. We see that as time goes on, he's committed to her, he loves her, but she's lost her father and mother, which would deepen her as a person. It is said that when someone is extremely beautiful, that their personality is shallow because they don't ever have to develop it. This would cause to deepen her through the pain that she would go through, even though she's an incredibly beautiful woman. It goes on to say, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her in as his own daughter. So it was when the king commanded a decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered in Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, so he noticed her above the rest, it seems, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave her beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and the maidservants to the best place in the house of the woman. So she immediately had favor, first of all among this guy that cared for them, and eventually before the king. Esther had not revealed her people or her family. There was a lot of persecution for the Jews that were taken into captivity. They were people that had been defeated, and they were brought into captivity. Mordecai had told her, don't tell people that you are from Israel. And so she had hid that. Mordecai, by the way, had also hid it. Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Then verse 11, and every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the woman's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So he cares about her every day. He's pacing up and down trying to get word of what's taking place in her life. And history says, scriptures don't tell us, but history says that Mordecai actually tried to hide her. That he knew that she was beautiful and she would be one that was chosen, and they had actually taken to try to hide her because of his fear of the way that she would be treated. It goes on to say here then in verse 12, each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus. After she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations of the women, for thus were the days of preparation appointed, 6 months of the oil of myrrh. And you remember that myrrh is an oil that is developed when it is crushed. It's one of the spices Jesus was given when he was born. It's one of the spices that was used for Jesus when he was prepared for his death, speaking about the crushing of the Messiah for the people of Israel. And here she's, you know, anointed in this oil for 6 months. 6 months of just being pampered, and these 7 maidservants putting oil on her every day. And then it says, and 6 months of perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. So 6 months of just soaking her in these different kinds of perfume. It says, thus prepared, each young woman went to the king. She was given whatever she desired to be taken with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. So she was given something when she would go that she, you know, from the area that she was in, kind of a gift. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of this person, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called her by name. So it's kind of the way the contest went. The lady would come in, she'd see the king, she'd talk with him a little bit, then she'd leave. If the king called her again by name, she'd come back. It's kind of like a, you know, we'll call you, don't you call us, kind of a thing. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abathiah, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her and his daughters to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king, the eunuch, had the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So in other words, it seems like this keeper of the eunuchs had her in mind all along. And she just seeks his advice, and he gives her advice as what to take, and that's what she does. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. So he fell in love with her. And she obtained grace and favor in the sight more than all of the other virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then I wonder if they sang, here she is, Miss Persia. No, I don't know. I don't know what they sang, but they put a crown on her head just like that, and she's chosen, and she's the winner. Then the king made a great feast. Uh-oh, here we go again. The feast of Esther for all of the officers and servants, and proclaimed a holiday in the province and gave gifts according to all the generosity of the king. So this guy has a feast. He starts giving all these kind of gifts. He even gives people off of their taxes. It says, When the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family of her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the commandment of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gates, two of the king's eunuchs. Mordecai, because he is related to Esther, because he's brought her up, has now obtained a place of authority. That's what the phrase sitting at the gates is all about. Because he's her stepdad, as it were, he's now been given a position of authority there within the city. And while he's there, he hears these two guys, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, becoming furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So just by chance, Mordecai overhears these two guys say they want to kill the king. Now, I believe the provenance of this book starts way back here. I think God is putting things into place. It says, so the matter became known to Mordecai. He told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. It says, and the inquiry was made into the matter, and it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. This book will come into play as time goes on within it. But so he is his faithfulness towards the king is revealed. Because he overhears this thing, they check it out, they go and they investigate, and they find evidence that these guys have been plotting against the king, and so they hang these guys on gallows. And now Mordecai has, power in before the king in showing that he really cared about him and saving him from this plot against the king. Then chapter 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Now enters the bad guy. We meet Ahasuerus in chapter 1, and we see that at best he is a foolish man in the decision that he makes. We meet Esther and Mordecai in chapter 2. Esther, the beautiful virgin who eventually becomes queen to him. Mordecai, her uncle, who has loved her and cared for her. And now Haman. And you got to get the best picture of a bad guy that you can get in your mind. And that is Haman. He is the baddest of all bad guys. It says, the son of, and it gives the name, and he is an Agagite, which an Agagite is in the family of the Amalekites. And you remember that the Amalekites were the one that would sneak up behind Israel when they were in the wilderness and would attack the weak ones. And because they did that, God said, I will wipe out the Amalekites completely. Then God gave Saul, King Saul, the first king of Israel, the command to wipe out all of the Amalekites. King Saul didn't do it. And even brought the king, a guy by the name of Agag, alive. And you remember when Samuel showed up, he was old and he was blind. And he said, you know, why didn't you do what God told you to do? And Saul said, I've done it all. He says, why do I hear cows and why do I hear sheep? And then he finally said, bring King Agag here. The Bible says that Samuel took a sword and hacked to death King Agag. Which you can imagine, it must have been a frightening thing for King Agag. Here's this old blind guy. And all right, where's he at? You know, bring him over here. Big Agag's going, at least get somebody who can see to do this thing. But this would be a descendant of Agag, so that they were not all wiped out. And now here comes this people again that has been set against Israel, and he's set against them as well. And it goes on to say, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with them. So King Ahasuerus lifts this man up so he is in power, and he's a wicked man. And it says, and all of the king's servants who were within the king's gates bowed down and paid homage to Haman. Because of the position that he was given, they were worshiping Haman, and everybody would bow down to him. For so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Mordecai refused to bow before him and give him homage. Most likely, even though it doesn't say, it is because he worships God. It's most likely. Look at what it goes on to say. It says, then the king's servants who were within the king's gates said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they had spoke to him daily that he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. So in other words, he said, I'm a Jew. I'm an Israeli. I'm a Hebrew. I will not bow down to this man. I believe that he was saying because of his belief and faith in God that he wouldn't bow down to him, even though it's not said specifically here. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay him homage, that wouldn't be hard to see, would it? You go out to the, going down the road, and this guy, everywhere he went, people stopped and turned and bowed down to him. And as he's going down the road, there's everybody doing it except for Mordecai. Everybody else is bowed down, and he's standing there. And maybe he was, more humble than that. Maybe he stood and looked to the ground while the thing went by. But he wouldn't be hard to see. And when he noticed that he didn't do that, that he didn't pay him homage, verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai instead. Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. You try to say that over and over and over and over again. So Haman decides, I want to wipe everybody out. Every Jew that is in this kingdom, I want to wipe out completely. He wants to totally destroy him. So that's his plan. That's what he sets out for. He says, this guy won't bow down to me. I want to destroy them all. Of course, he has no clue that Esther is Jewish as well, and that she would be killed according to his plan. It says, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they came to Pur, that is, to Lot, before Haman, to determine the day of the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And I don't understand all that. Then Haman did a little research. I couldn't figure it out, so I gave up. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of all of your kingdom. They had been dispersed not only into Babylon, but they had been dispersed out into all different parts of the world. And because of the things that God had given them in their dietary laws, in a certain way that they would look, certain ways that the men would cut their beards, they were able to keep their communities wherever they went. By the way, that went on not only from this dispersion, but from the dispersion after Titus had dispersed them from Jerusalem in 66 AD. The same thing was true. They went out into all different parts of the world, but yet as a people, the Jews have always been able to keep their identity, and they had done that. And it goes on to say they differ from all of the people. There are differences with them that's different from everybody else. And they did not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, we already know this about King Ahasuerus, he's prone to let other people make decisions for him. He's not making all the right decisions. When people are coming to him with ideas, he's prone to take those ideas. You can bet that his court knew that as well. And that they knew the first one to get to him, the first one to bring up these ideas, is the one that's going to be listened to. That's Haman. It says, if it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the treasury. So he's saying, we're going to pay the people who do the work, and we're going to bring the money into the treasury, and they'll get the money from those who he destroys. It says, so the king took his signet ring. It was probably the money that made Ahasuerus go, yeah, I like that idea. Let's get more money in here. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of that guy, the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with as it seems good to you. So in other words, whatever you take from the people who you're going to kill and destroy, that's going to be yours to do whatever you want to with. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month. And the decree was written according to all that Haman commanded to the king's satraps, the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all of the people, to every province according to the script, and to every people in their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus. It was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by carriers to all of the king's provinces. So now throughout all of the provinces came these letters that the Jews were to be gathered up and they are to be killed. It says to destroy all and to kill all the inhabitants of the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel, So the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. There was this confusion. All of the Jews, children, women, men, were to be gathered together and killed in one day. Now that's where we're going to end today. We'll pick up and hopefully, Lord willing, do three chapters next week as well as we make our way through here. But at this point, things just look desperate for them. At this point, and in fact, if you've never read the book of Esther and you don't know the conclusion of this story, at this point, how they could get out of this is beyond men to figure out. There has been a command from the king that these people are to be killed. We know that things are set up. And if Esther, who is Jewish, is not in the king's court, then there is no way to rescue them. God had already set things in place. See, sometimes in our lives, things look really bad. Sometimes it looks like things have just gone awry and there's no way out. But know that God is always in control and that God in His providence sets things up beforehand so that we are able to be rescued. And I think this, if we were to give testimonies of how we've seen God's providence work in our lives and what we thought were hopeless situations, I think we could stand up and give testimonies of it over and over again about how God's providence has moved in our lives. Sometimes you might even think it's horrible, like Mordecai did. If history is right, Mordecai tried to hide her. Well, he was going against the very thing that God wanted to do. To Mordecai, it was a frightful thing that he was taken into this, you know, this harem for the king to enter into this beauty pageant. It was horrifying to him. But yet it was God's very plan that that would take place. Sometimes things happen in our lives, and to us, it might be horrifying. How could that happen? And yet, it could be God's very plan in your life to bring those things about. Let's stand up and pray.